Ibrahim Raisi is sworn in as Iran's new president in a ceremony attended by officials from dozens of countries. World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Ibrahim Raisi taking the oath of office before Parliament as Iran's eighth president.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Raisi was sworn in at a ceremony attended by a host of local and foreign dignitaries. The new president said that his administration will try to fulfill people's demands, which include administering justice, fighting corruption, and eliminating discrimination. He said religious democracy has taken hold in Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Raisi said that he was pleased to have found the chance to serve the nation. He held Iran's presidential vote as a democratic election held in the face of U.S. sanctions, the enemy's psychological warfare, and a fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. He also said that Iran will continue to stand by the oppressed nations.
No matter where injustice and crime happen, be it in the heart of Europe or in the United States, in Africa or Yemen, in Syria or Palestine, we will stand by the oppressed.
Raisi also denounced foreign interference in the region. He stressed that regional crises should be resolved through dialogue among regional states. He said a central plank of his administration's policy is to extend a hand of friendship to neighboring countries. The new president also underscored the importance of constructive interaction with the world. President Raisi said that U.S. sanctions against Iran should be lifted. He noted that he has plans to curb inflation and shore up the economy. Let me invite a couple of guests and talk to them about what's going on. So we'll have Mustafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political analyst. We'll also have with us Bijan Tavassili, political commentator, joining us from Hamburg. Welcome to all of you, gentlemen. Let's start with Mr. Khoshchesh in Tehran. Let's have your, Mustafa, assessment of... I just gave you a gist of what happened during that 90-minute ceremony. Let's have your initial assessment of what went on, the points that were raised.
Hello, viewers, and thanks for having me. Good to be with you again. I don't know if you've discussed this or not, but, you know, it was good to see that all the specified seats at ceremony were occupied by guests. You know, there were corona outbreak considerations. That's why the duration of this ceremony, as well as the endorsement ceremony a couple of days ago with the Iranian Supreme Leader, they were both, you know, contained to fewer hours, to be short as possible because of coronavirus protocols. And that's why some officials, foreign officials, avoided traveling because of coronavirus protocols in their own countries or in Iran. Still, the number of high-ranking foreign dignitaries and guests, including presidents, vice presidents, prime ministers, parliament speakers, vice speakers, as well as heads of parliamentary commissions, taking part in this ceremony, according to information and data that I have, stood higher than the same number back in 2013 when President Rouhani started his first term. And it shows that many people around the world are very much interested to see Iran's change under President Raisi. There will be a big change. As Mr. Ghalibaf said, there were shortcomings of President Rouhani's performance. You know, Rouhani put all his eggs in the basket of the JCPOA. He was not attentive to other solutions that he could provide in order to, you know, improve Iranian economy. Under his tenure, under his presidency, expanding ties with the neighboring countries was not prioritized, actually. China, Russia, Latin America, and Africa didn't witness expanded ties with Iran during his tenure because he was too much focused on the JCPOA and on the United States and Europe to resolve the differences with them, which, of course, didn't work because of the Americans' disloyalty to the deal repeatedly, as expected. So the people who voted for Raisi actually expected him to work on those shortcomings, and he appeared very strong, as promised by Parliament Speaker Ghalibaf, and also by President Raisi himself. They are to work very hard in order to increase efficiency of the government and also improve Iranian people's welfare and economic condition by doing a lot of things that Rouhani never did, including reinvigorating domestic economy. They have over a dozen projects, mega projects, to improve Iranian economy in those areas that never received the attention of the previous government pretty well. Also, in area of foreign policy, as expected, Raisi is you know, has an agenda that's somehow amusing. He will be a fearful enemy, more fearful and powerful enemy of including Israel. As expected, he is going to reinvigorate resistance movement and resistance front groups, Palestinians, Hezbollah, and also others. At the same time, he will be a more powerful friend for neighbors, for Muslim countries, for anyone in the world that has extended a friendly hand to Iran. Now, what is amusing in this is that now countries like Saudi Arabia should make a wise decision to let everyone know if they mean to stand in the first or the second category. Because if they choose to be a friend and go for a strategic shift in their foreign policy, and by the way, they have not done so far, despite the very fact that there have been talks with the Saudis between Iranians and the Saudis.
Mr. Khrushchev, if you allow me, let me go to Hamburg and put this question to Bijan Tavassoli. Now, Bijan, what would be the, let's say, there are a host of issues, you know, that Mr. Raisi will be facing. I don't want to mention them. I want you to talk about them. What would be the three top priorities for Mr. Raisi's administration to begin with?
Well, it's really hard to make such a list of priorities as the world is in turmoil right now. Obviously, there's a global pandemic ravaging throughout the world, and Iran has to face this reality, and Mr. Raisi, as president, will be fighting it. And this will be at the top of his mind, I believe, for the foreseeable future at the beginning of this term. But of course, the economic issues in Iran and economic developmental issues will, I think, be just as important, and they will not stop when the pandemic ends. And there he has to make progress, because that is, after all, what he promised. And Iranian voters are going to take him to account on those promises. And I believe, as he has said today, he intends fully to fulfill all those promises as regards to economic development. And thirdly, maybe related to the second issue, is of course the question of the lifting of sanctions. And if it's not possible to agree on a deal with the United States, then there have to be other ways that have to be found to really effectively fight the sanctions. Talks directly with Russia and China, talks with the European Union. But he has today professed much interest in diplomatic initiatives in such a way. And maybe let me just make one more point that is often overlooked. Because what we've seen today, if you ask any scholar of history, has only recently become the norm. It has been an anomaly for like centuries in human history that you can just witness a peaceful transfer of power. Mm-hmm. And even in many countries today, that is not what voters can expect after an election. let's remember that just at January 6th in Washington, D.C. in the United States, there were riots, and Democrats claimed that Trump supporters want to overthrow the results of the election.
Right.
So even developed countries like the United States, such a thing that we've seen today, the completely peaceful transfer of power to a new president, is not normal. And so we can celebrate this, and we can celebrate democracy today.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this special coverage on the Iranian presidential swearing-in ceremony. Let me thank my guests. We had Mostafa Khoshesh, journalist and political analyst in Tehran, and Bijan Tavassuli, political commentator out of Hamburg, with his contribution.
Well, the United Nations has expressed concern about the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan's southern city of Lashkargah, where heavy clashes are ongoing between government forces and the Taliban.
Tens of thousands of people could be trapped by the fighting. Our humanitarian colleagues also tell us that in Helmand and Kandahar, there are reported increased civilian casualties, destruction or damage to civilian houses, as well as to critical infrastructure, including hospitals.
The UN spokesman added that medical centers and health workers are becoming overwhelmed by the number of wounded people. At least 40 civilians have been killed during the battle for Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province. Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban have also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. Russia has rejected speculations about a recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman, saying there is a lot of conflicting information regarding the incident. Russia's deputy permanent representative to the UN said the details provided so far are based on highly likely analyses. Dmitry Polyansky called for establishing facts before rushing to any conclusions or actions. He reacted when asked if the Security Council should address the matter. The oil tanker came under attack last Thursday. The U.S., Britain, and Israel hastily accused Iran of being involved in the attack without providing any evidence. Iran denied the allegations as fabricated, groundless, and politically biased. Iran's deputy ambassador to the U.N. also warned of suspicious attempts to create false flag maritime incidents. The Islamic Republic has also warned of a crushing response to any threats against its national security. A senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has slammed Washington for plotting against regional countries. Ali Farabi says the axis of resistance has the power to respond to, quote, evil deeds of the United States.
For the past 42 years, the U.S. and its allies, including its illegitimate child, Israel, have been plotting against the Islamic Republic, including with their false accusations. They are angry and upset because the U.S. and Israel have been defeated in different arenas. That's the reason they resort to anything to save themselves from their miserable situation. Wicked entities have been plotting against not only the resistance front, but other Muslim nations as well. But they should know that the resistance front is so powerful that it can respond to any evil deed of the U.S. and Israel. The American and Israeli regimes are weak right now, and the resistance front is strong enough to change the balance of power.
A bomb blast has targeted the residential building of Afghanistan's deputy defense minister, killing several people and wounding many others. The deputy minister was not hurt, however, in the attack claimed by the Taliban militants. Amin Alami reports.
A huge truck bomb blast hit the residence of Afghanistan's acting defense minister, General Bismillah Mohammadi. Following the blast, the Taliban militants entered the building and began exchanging fire with security forces. The acting defense minister was not at home, but his security team safely evacuated his family members. Tuesday night's blast, followed by a series of attacks, took place here in Kabul's heavily fortified area known as the Green Zone. This district in central Kabul houses government offices, presidential palace, and residences of high-ranking officials, as well as foreign embassies and international organizations. Soon after the attack, Afghanistan's acting defense minister shared a video message and assured the nation of his safety. In the meantime, he warned the Taliban of resolute response by government forces.
The suicide attack was launched on my residential building by the bloodthirsty terrorists. By the grace of God, me and my family members were not harmed in the attack, but unfortunately, some of my bodyguards got wounded. I assure you, the honorable nation of Afghanistan, that such incidents will have the least negative impact on our will to defend you and our country.
Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid claimed responsibility for the attack. It comes as the militants press ahead with an offensive that is putting pressure on provincial capitals in the south and west of the country. Following the attack, most of Kabul residents took to their rooftops or streets and chanted slogans in support of Afghan national security and defense forces. The locals, however, say they are after peace and security in their country. Hamid, an Afghan driver, was wounded in the Taliban attack. He says welcomes any effort to bring peace to Afghanistan.
I was here when the huge blast happened. There was a smoke and fire, but despite my wounds, I'm tired of war and welcome any move by both sides to honestly resume the intra-Afghan talks.
Attack on the residence of Afghanistan's acting defense minister was not the only security incident in Kabul, as a few hours after Afghan troops gunned down all attackers inside this building, another blast rocked the area around the National Directorate of Security that injured two civilians and a security official. Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks recently to capture some key provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
COVID-19 infections worldwide have passed the shocking figure of 200 million as the more infectious Delta variant drives up cases. The pandemic has also left over 4.2 million people dead since it started. It took over a year for COVID-19 cases to hit the 100 million mark, while the next 100 million were reported in just over 6 months. The United States is the worst hit by the outbreak so far, with deaths nearing 615,000. Brazil has the second deadliest outbreak with almost 560,000 fatalities. The Latin American country has also reported over 20 million cases. Official figures show at least 2.6% of the world's population have been infected, but the true figure is likely higher due to the limited testing in many places. Australia's New South Wales state has reported a record number of new COVID-19 cases and 5 deaths from the virus. The state registered 262 infections, the largest daily tally since the pandemic began. Most of them have been reported in Australia's largest city, Sydney, where 5 million residents were told to stay home some 6 weeks ago. The steep rise in cases has prompted the authorities to expand the lockdown to Sydney's neighboring regions. There were also 5 positive tests in Newcastle, a coastal city north of Sydney, prompting officials there to shutter schools and issue the stay-at-home order for at least a week. Barely 20% of Australians have been fully vaccinated due to supply problems and pockets of vaccine hesitancy. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, said net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and companies are taking bold action to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Oxfam Warns Reforestation Hopes Threaten Global Food Security. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Charity Oxfam has warned governments and businesses hoping to plant trees and restore forests in order to reach net zero emissions must sharply limit such efforts to avoid driving up food prices in the developing world. According to a report titled Tightening the Net, Net Zero Climate Targets, Implications for Land and Food Equity, planting trees has been mooted as one of the key ways of tackling the climate crisis. But the amount of land needed for such forests would be vast, and planting even a fraction of the area needed to offset global greenhouse gas emissions would encroach on the land needed for crops to feed a growing population. At least 1.6 billion hectares of land, an area five times the size of India, equivalent to all the land now farmed on the planet, would be required to reach net zero emissions for the planet by 2050, via tree planting alone. While no one is suggesting planting trees to that extent, the report's author said it gave an idea of the scale of the planting required and how limited offsetting should be if food price rises are to be avoided. Nafkoti Dabi, climate policy lead at Oxfam and co-author of the report, explained, "It is difficult to tell how much land will be required as governments have not been transparent about how they plan to meet their net zero commitments. But many countries and companies are talking about afforestation and reforestation, and the first question is, where is this land going to come from? According to some estimates, food prices could rise by as much as 80% by 2050 if offsetting emissions through forestry is overused. About 350 million hectares of land, an area roughly the size of India, could be used for offsetting without disrupting agriculture around the world. But taken together, the plans for offsetting the countries and companies around the world could soon exceed this." Nafkoti Dabi said, "Already hundreds of millions of people around the world are going hungry. We need to consult countries on how they're going to use their land. And countries and companies need to reduce their emissions first, before relying on offsetting. We also need to reduce emissions from agriculture, which is the second biggest source of emissions globally." The report also found that two of the most commonly used offsetting measures, that is, reforestation and the planting of new forests, were among the worst at putting food security at risk. According to the analysis, far better were nature-based solutions that focused on forest management, agroforestry, the practice of combining crop cultivation or pasture with growing trees, as well as pasture management and soil management in croplands. These would allow people to use the land for food while sequestering carbon. Darby explained, "We are not against afforestation and reforestation, and we do not want to stop people doing these things, but they should not be used at a large scale and should be combined with other methods, such as agroforestry." She gave the example of Switzerland, which is planning to offset about 12.5% of its greenhouse gas emissions through carbon credits from projects in other countries, including Peru and Ghana. Oxfam estimated to reach that target would take an area the size of Costa Rica. Some companies are also planning to use carbon offsetting based on trees and land as part of their efforts to reach net zero emissions. Oxfam found that many of these plans, taken together, could amount to an overuse of land. For instance, four leading energy companies would require an area twice the size of the United Kingdom for their offsetting. According to Oxfam's estimates, Shell would need about 28.6 million hectares of land by 2050, while Total Energy plans to offset about 7% of its emissions, needing about 2.6 million hectares of land by 2050. Eni, another energy company, has plans for 8 million hectares of forestry, but Oxfam calculates that double this could be needed. BP has not set out its plans in detail, but Oxfam estimates it is likely to require as much as 22.5 million hectares of land for offsetting as much as 15% of its emissions. Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, called for companies and governments to cut their emissions drastically rather than relying on offsets. He said, "Too many companies and too many governments are hiding behind the smokescreen of net zero emissions to continue dirty business as usual activities. A prime example of the doublethink we are seeing is the oil and gas sector trying to justify its ongoing extraction of fossil fuels by promising unrealistic carbon removal schemes that require ludicrous amounts of land." He added, "Net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and some companies are taking bold action to cut emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it." A spokesperson for British Petroleum BP said, "BP does not intend to rely on offsets to meet either our 2025 emissions reduction targets or 2030 aims. However, they may help us to go beyond those aims if we can. We do support the use of carbon offsets or credits by companies, countries, and society to achieve faster and lower cost pathways to net zero emissions and help meet the Paris climate goals." Shell said it did not recognize Oxfam's estimates. A spokesperson said, "Meeting a net zero target requires fundamentally changing the forms of energy Shell supplies and then using offsets at the margin to compensate for any remaining emissions. That is, we're changing the products that we sell." The spokesperson for Shell added, "As Shell shifts its portfolio to more and more renewable and low-carbon sources of energy, it could well be that the emissions associated with energy sold by Shell in 2050 is less than the quantity of carbon credits we expect to be able to supply our customers in 2030.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa bihi nasta'in. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah. We have been discussing the eighth supplication of this prayer manual, and that is on the supplication of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam when seeking refuge from evil traits and blameworthy actions. We are still in the first phrase, which is that Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min hayajanil hirs. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam expresses and says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from the arousal of greed.
Rabbana. Salvation, a way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana.
What we started discussing in our previous session is that what is the origin of the greed that we find in ourselves, so that we know how to treat the greed, so that we can abstain from the greed and fight against the greed that has come in ourselves and that we have developed throughout the different years that we have seen. So it is very important to know what is the origin. In order for that, we said that we must study the soul and its faculties. And we mentioned a very beautiful passage from Mulla Hadi Sabzawari in his commentary of Dua al-Jawshan al-Kabir. And he talks about the faculties of the human being, that the human being basically has three important faculties: the faculty of intellect, the faculty of comprehension, and then the faculty of appetite, that is al-quwwa al-shahawiyya, and then the faculty of anger, al-quwwa al-ghadabiyya. And we said that, as he mentions in his beautiful work of commentary of Dua al-Jawshan al-Kabir, he says that these three faculties have three states. One is the state of excess, one is the state of negligence, and one is the state of equilibrium. We don't want to mention the details. We already read out the details in our previous session. But in short, he mentioned that when these three faculties are in their states of equilibrium, then we find, for example, the intellect is in the state of wisdom. That is the balance of the intellect, the intellectual faculty. The faculty of desire and the faculty of appetite that we mentioned, its equilibrium is in the state of chastity, when a person is chaste and does not go through the excesses of this faculty, he is known as a person who is chaste. And with regard to the irascible faculty or the faculty of anger also, if you go and see the two extremes, they are blameworthy. The recklessness is blameworthy, and cowardice also in the other end is blameworthy. But the person who has the balance of this is known as a person who is intrepid and brave. So these, the bravery, chastity, and wisdom, when these three come together, the person is in the state of equilibrium of the soul. It is here that very good characteristics come out from him. But let us say he develops any kind of problem with regard to the balance, then you find that evil and blameworthy characteristics come out from him.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, it is important for us to also mention some interesting things that other scholars have mentioned with regard to the definition of hirs. For example, one of the very esteemed and great scholars who has written a beautiful commentary of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah, and obviously this commentary overshadows so many other commentaries. It is known as Riyadu Salikin, the gardens of the spiritual wayfarers. It is written by a person known as Sayyid Ali Madani. In his commentary and exegesis of Sahifa Sajjadiyah, he says that it is said, he quotes many different sayings about the definition of hirs, which we translate as greed. He says that qila wa huwa taraful ifrat fi al-quwwa ash-shahawiyya at-taliba li shahawat ad-dunya wa idha waqa' al-ifrat fiha talabat ma yadurru bid-din. That means that it is said that hirs is the exaggerated side of the faculty of appetite, which seeks the pleasures of the world. Hence, hirs and excess desire is an offshoot of the disequilibrium. All right. So, actually, if you go and see the reality here, what Sayyid Ali Madani is trying to say, that one of the sayings about hirs is the same thing that we talk about when we say that, you know, the excess of the faculty of appetite is known as cupidity or gluttony. He says the hirs is this, basically, according to one of the definitions. Obviously, he doesn't say that I define it as that way. The definition he gives is, you know, the intensity of desire, which is a linguistic and lexical definition that is all right. But among the definitions he gives is the same thing that we call cupidity and sharah, and that is the excess of the faculty of appetite. He calls, or this person whom he is quoting from, he calls as, you know, hirs. He says this is the same thing as hirs. Sharah and hirs are one. But if you go and see our riwayat, we find that no, there is a difference. The difference is that this state of cupidity and the state of, you know, having excess of desire in shahwa is the force behind hirs. So it is as if this greed that comes about is because of that imbalance, which is sharah and cupidity. Not that the hirs itself is the sharah and cupidity, as some people mention, as he has quoted. For example, you find Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, shiddatul hirs min quwwati sharah wa da'fi ad-din. The intensity of greed is from the strength of cupidity and weakness of religion. So you find that he doesn't say that shiddatul hirs huwa quwwatu sharah. Doesn't mean that, you know, that hirs is sharah itself. That is, greed is cupidity. No, greed is not cupidity. Greed is an offshoot of cupidity. When a person has an imbalanced soul and he does excess with regard to his desire, then hirs comes about. So the origin of hirs is cupidity, the imbalance of the faculty of desire. Inshallah, we'll continue with our discussion in our next session. We come to the end of the program. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wasallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin.
That was the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Hargiz najirat to abad aqa kasi jay to ra hargiz makhad az kaf dahan عشق و تولای تو را
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden said Tuesday, 3rd of August, he believes New York Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign following the release of a damning report concluding that the governor sexually harassed nearly a dozen women over a seven-year period and created a toxic workplace. The article you're about to hear has been written by Lisa Hagen, a politics reporter for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Biden Calls on Cuomo to Resign After Damning Report on Sexual Harassment, Toxic Workplace. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 3rd of August, he believes New York Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign following the release of a damning report concluding that the governor sexually harassed nearly a dozen women over a seven-year period and created a toxic workplace. As allegations surfaced against Andrew Cuomo in late 2020 and earlier this year, President Biden said back in March that the New York Democrat should step down if the claims are proven true, adding that he'd likely be prosecuted. Shortly after the report's publication on Tuesday morning, a defiant Andrew Cuomo pushed back against the claims in video remarks, making it clear he would not voluntarily leave his post. Following his scheduled remarks about COVID-19 vaccination efforts, President Biden was asked by reporters whether he stands by his remarks from March about Cuomo resigning. He briefly said he stands by that recommendation, noting that he hasn't read the report and only knows the end result. Biden confirmed that he hasn't spoken with the New York governor since the publication of the report. "I stand by that statement, yes," President Biden said on Tuesday afternoon from the White House East Room. When pressed if Cuomo should be impeached if he doesn't step down, Biden added, "Let's take one thing at a time here. I think he should resign." A report conducted by independent investigators appointed by New York Attorney General Letitia James's office said Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed 11 women between 2013 and 2020. The report said Cuomo broke state and federal law as well as his office's own policies and engaged in unwanted touching, in addition to making inappropriate comments to women. The women, some named and others referred to anonymously, included former and current staffers and state employees, as well as a state trooper who at the time worked on his security detail. As a part of a five-month investigation, Cuomo provided sworn testimony and denied the claims made by four women and generally denied touching anyone inappropriately. In his testimony and during his public remarks on Tuesday, the governor said he often hugs and kisses people on the cheek. He testified he may have kissed some staffers on the lips, but denied those claims from one of the unnamed executive assistants and former staffer, Lindsay Boylan, who went public with her claims last year. Investigators characterized Cuomo's pushback as blanket denials, while also noting that his memory of events stood in stark contrast to the strength, specificity, and corroboration of the complainant's recollections. "What matters to me at the end of the day is getting the most done I can for you," Andrew Cuomo said in response to the report. "I will not be distracted from that job." President Biden isn't the only high-profile Democrat or elected official in Washington to call for Andrew Cuomo's resignation. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, New York's two senators, reiterated calls for him to step down. Three congressmen from the state, including House Democratic Caucus Chairman Hakeem Jeffries, also said Andrew Cuomo should resign. The investigation has found that the governor engaged in abusive behavior towards women, including subordinates, creating a hostile work environment, and violated state and federal laws. Hakeem Jeffries said in a joint statement with Democratic Representative Tom Suozzi and Representative Gregory Meeks, "The time has come for Governor Andrew Cuomo to do the right thing for the people of New York State and resign." Also, state assembly Democrats who hold the majority in the chamber held an emergency meeting on Tuesday, 3rd of August, to discuss the matter, with a pre-scheduled meeting on impeachment set for Monday. The state Senate president, Democrat Andrea Stewart-Cousins, reiterated her call for Andrew Cuomo to resign. New York City's likely next mayor, Eric Adams, called on the assembly to impeach Cuomo if he refuses to resign. Meanwhile, in a defiant and defensive taped statement, the 63-year-old Andrew Cuomo denied some of the allegations against him and said other behavior or statements were misinterpreted and hinted at political motives by would-be rivals. It was a classic Cuomo response from the famously bombastic and aggressive politician. Not only did Cuomo deny he had done anything wrong, but he cast himself as a victim, saying the entire episode had been a hard and painful episode for me and my family. It now appears that Governor Andrew Cuomo is virtually alone in his opinion that he should keep his job. Calls for his immediate departure are mounting.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Here I am, pleading at your door,
Send me your mercy, send me your peace, oh, I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. We as human beings, we have two dimensions now. Obviously, it is difficult to explain the relationship between those two dimensions on this program. So whoever wishes to know more about this should refer to the legitimate scholars. What I mean by legitimate, those who have studied ilm al-nafs, those who have studied, you know, philosophy properly in order to understand the relationship between body and soul. Now, when we say ilm al-nafs, it does not mean psychology, you know. No. Please do not translate it as psychology. Psychology is the wrong translation for ilm al-nafs. One of the better translations is spiritual anthropology. But again, it's a long discussion. But the relationship between body and soul. And one other thing that we know is that one pulls us towards the material realm, the other one pulls us towards the divine realm. And because we are more attached to our bodies, we are more attached to the material realm, we are therefore more attached to evil at times. And we have to force ourselves to do good. And we see this quite often. And when it comes, for example, the time for Fajr, within those who are attached to the divine realm, those whose soul has superiority over the body and uses the body just as a purely vehicle to perform these compulsory acts and the obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for them is easy. They get up and they go, they wash their faces. You know, no, for most of us, it's a slog. And therefore, the Holy Prophet in this tradition shows us that we as human beings, because we are so attached, unfortunately, to the material realm, we are pulled down towards it. So the Holy Prophet then gives us this advice. He says, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, force yourselves to do good. Force yourselves to do good. And really exert it. And in the next one, he also says, and exert yourselves therein. Right? As much effort as you can put in to do good, to perform your duties. The minimum is to perform your wajibats and to stay away from the muharramat. Perform that is compulsory and what is compulsory, and to, you know, refrain from what is prohibited and forbidden. For verily, evil is something man naturally tends towards. So in order to kind of, you know, build and to strengthen that particular side of us which is attached to the divine, we have to force and make effort. Whereas if we leave it naturally, we will come to the material realm, and the material realm is nothing but facade, nothing but corruption, and we will just fall into it and do it. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to expand our spiritual horizons and to attach ourselves to the divine realms, inshaAllah. Bihaqqi Muhammad wa Ahli Bayt al-Tayyibin al-Tahirin al-Ma'sumin. InshaAllah, until next time, my dear brother.